Hey there, this is Seth Wires from Channel 9, coming to you from NDC, London. I have here the very famous Troy.
How you doing, thanks, buddy? Yeah, good, good. I mean, other than being cold, don't let the tan give it away.
But I know.
This is London and it is cold.
It is London, but you're from Australia where it's the dead of summer.
Yeah.
And your house is like right there on the beach. I see these tweets of him. I'm just going to get on my jet ski now. It's just pretty sad for me.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. So you are known for security-related stuff, primarily for a site that you built. Before we get to this site, let's talk about security nowadays. It feels like people all of a sudden are now interested in security, but because of very specific reasons. Why don't we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing, but security is just, it seems to have gotten a lot more mainstream in the last few years. And I think it's become mainstream because we have seen it so much in the press and it's impacted so many people. So, you know, we've seen really large data breaches like Adobe in 2013, 152 million odd accounts. You know, that was a big thing, 152 million.
That's a lot.
But we've seen it become very mainstream through things like the Target hacking,
uh-huh.
you know, 40 odd million credit cards. Obviously, Sony was in the news a couple of years ago, which was a very interesting one for many reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And in more recent times, the big one that's been in the news is Ashley Madison.
Yeah.
And what sort of gets me with this is that this is like mainstream news. This is not some sort of techie thing, which if I ask my mum and dad, they'd have no idea about. This is things that is on the front page of the consumer newspapers, and it's on the, you know, the 5 o'clock news. It's a big thing.
And not only that, but like regular, I've seen, and correct me if I'm wrong, regular news people have been calling you and saying, can you give us a statement about this kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's been crazy. I mean, I've been on CNN and all over Forbes and like everything lately. But
which is for tech
bizarre.
Folks, it's not normal, right? But it is the new normal. It turns out that there is so much information that we're generating that's very private, and we're sort of allowing people to sort of have it, and we feel like they should be safeguarding it, but they're not.
Well, they're not sufficiently. That's what the evidence would suggest, right? And the thing is that often you see these reports, and they like to break it down by verticals. And this is the healthcare industry, and the fun. It's just everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, one that comes to mind since you and I spoke last time, actually, is we've had things like VTech, the toy maker, right? So the guys making. Like imagine an iPad made by Fisher-Price. It's like plasticky and yellow and you give it to your kids. And your kids enter their personal information into it. And you know, guess what? The magic of the web, all of that goes into a server somewhere. And then someone breaks into the server and has little Johnny's name and his gender and his age and the foreign key association back to the parent with the physical address. And you're just going...
That's scary.
Like we saw Ashley Madison last year and went, all right, this is unprecedented for so many reasons. And then we see this and we go, well, this is unprecedented for so many reasons. And we're at the very start of 2016 yet, and we haven't had an unprecedented thing.
Yeah, but we're only like, what, 13 days into the year?
By the time this goes live,
you know,
it's like, who knows? And this is kind of like it's equal parts depressing and kind of exciting that you just never know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So what can we do to protect ourselves, so to speak? I mean, because it turns out that when we establish these relationships with companies, we have to give them some kind of information. But what do we do to protect ourselves?
And this is the thing, and people sort of said to me, say the case of VTech, the toy maker, they said, well, look, you know, should they have had that data? And that the difficulty is that for an organization like that, in order to provide a service where two kids can talk to each other, and they want to find people to talk to that are probably the same gender, a similar sort of age, and they want to talk by name, they kind of need that information.
Sure.
So it's a little bit hard to say that they collected the wrong thing, but I think the question in a case like that is it the right thing to give your kids information to a service?
Right.
Now, you know, I've got a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I probably would not put their details online at this point in time. Not in that way. I guess the other thing is that you've got to sort of work with the expectation that the things that you create online may at some time be public. So if you think about Ashley Madison, the number of people that got left in such a dire predicament because they used their work email address in order to sign up to a site designed for the express intention of having an affair. Now, you know, look, a pro tip on that. If that is your thing, not your thing, but someone else's thing, anybody out there, go and get a throwaway email account. Create something random at gmail.com or use something that's not traceable. But the point being, in an answer to your question, you need to work on the assumption that the things you create online may at some time be public.
Right.
And look, I even do this with Facebook, right? So I put things on Facebook, like photos of my kids, which I would prefer to keep private. But if it was all made public and everybody had access to everything I put online, it's not going to do me any harm.
Right. That changes the way fundamentally that people should think, because we live in a culture right now where everybody is taking their everyone's doing Snapchat. Everybody is doing taking pictures of themselves and putting it on the whatever.
Some take more, what should we say, revealing pictures than others. I would think about whether you want to take those. That would be a good tip.
Absolutely. Okay. So one of the services that you stood up was Have I Been Pwned? And this is an Azure website that you have. It has a lot of records. What does this site do?
Yeah, right. So what this website does is it aggregates data breaches. So we're at 255 million something records at the moment from 67 different data breaches. So, you know, if we scroll down a little bit here, we'll see what some of these top ones are. And these are incidents where a website such as Adobe has been compromised and then all the data has been put out there and made public. So anyone, you know, right now you can go to Google, do a Google search and find the Adobe data and you can get 152 million records. You can do a Google search and find Ashley Madison and find 30 million odd people that were signed up for the accounts. So what this service does is it aggregates that information and then it allows you to search through it and see what your exposure is. Because what got me, and in fact I'll give you a demo, I'll search for me because my email address is public. If I look for my email address, we'll see all the places that I have been compromised, which unfortunately is on three different sites. So my account was on Triple O Web Host, much to my surprise as well.
And I saw that sort of interchange, right?
So, and this is the other thing. Sometimes people have accounts in places without even knowing it. This was one of the defenses of Ashley Madison members, where they said, wasn't like someone else created my account. And some of them were probably telling the truth in that you can put anyone else's email address into a service. And part of the problem as well, these breaches happen and it sort of becomes an issue of was the person in there or were they not?
Right.
Because if they were, there's all these other shades of gray in terms of what was the context. So for me, you know, I had no actual activity in there. Someone else had created the account. They'd never verified the email address. They couldn't because it got sent to me. Anyway, so you know, in my case, I was on the Triple O Web Host breach. I was in Adobe. I had several accounts in Adobe, and I was also in Patreon. So what I would find interesting as a sort of non-owner of this site, even non-techie, is look at this. My personal info has been redistributed around publicly three different times. Adobe has plain text password hints. I've got sensitive information that talks about what my password is in Adobe. Patreon had other information about who I was supporting. I was supporting a podcast, giving them a few bucks a month.
Sure.
Now that's there.
So, and the crazy thing is that depending on the breach, the level of exposure could be even higher. Like, for example, the fact that somebody at 000 Web Host has your email now, it's kind of a public email, not a big deal. The fact that at Patreon you're supporting somebody, not a big deal in this case, but let's just say you're supporting an organization that, I don't know, that you're certainly entitled to, but maybe will cause rifts or problems with you personally, that's bad. And then finally Adobe, they have access to sensitive information regarding your passwords.
Yeah.
And then you get to like target breaches where they have your credit card. Or you get to, for example, there has been breaches on some of the health insurance people in the United States. That's really sensitive information.
So I think there are a couple of interesting things you said there. So one of the things is Triple O Web Host, I wouldn't, assuming I had a legit account, I wouldn't care too much about people knowing I had that there, and I wouldn't care too much about knowing, say, what websites I had on the service. Right. I do care about the fact they stored all the passwords in plain text.
That is bad, yeah.
Because that means that for the vast majority of people, someone can take those passwords and they can log into the person's Gmail account or their social sites or whatever it may be. You know, so to me, that is a really significant thing.
Absolutely. And I know I've been hashing passwords since the beginning of time, and everyone would say, hey, Seth, I forgot my password. Can you give it to me? I'd say, no. I don't know it. Even if I were to look at the database, I wouldn't know it.
And you know, even that depends on how you're hashing. So part of my talk this week, actually, one of the sites that was compromised was Stratfor, did intelligence reports. And they hashed passwords with MD5 and no salt, which meant that you could take the hash, and you can literally take hashes and Google them, and Google will say, this is the plain text password.
And then you can back engineer the forward hash.
Well, then you know what the plain text is, so you can then go and log onto the person's other accounts. But yeah, this was a case where there was no salt, so there was no randomness to each one of these password hashes. So it wasn't just a question, and this is something that often comes up. Site gets compromised, and they go, yeah, we hashed passwords. And the people that know go, okay, well, that's great. How did you hash it? Did you do it the bad way, which can be easily cracked? Or did you do it the really solid way? And there are a lot of different areas in between which they could have done it.
So what is a good solid way? When you say salting a hash, my understanding is that you pass in an extra sort of secret thing that you have as a company, and then that is used in the hashing algorithm.
So your salt is normally random bytes. So you'd say, okay, look, let's imagine I created a password which is a password with a zero, mm-hmm. so they don't know that it's... Don't do that. Yeah. Anyway, password with a zero, and you
ABC
create...
ABC123.
QWERTY, all the popular ones. Yeah. Now, if you did that and it was hashed, and you say hashed it with MD5 and then just stored that, every single person who had ABC123 as a password would have the same resulting hash.
Right.
And what the salt does is salt is random bytes that's added to the password before it's hashed, and then you store the result of that and the random bytes in the database. When someone comes and logs in, you get their account based on the username, you add the random bytes back to the password they give you, you hash it and compare it. So it basically gives randomness, which is good. Now, that the problem is that if you had, say, salted SHA-1 hashes, SHA-1's very fast to calculate, and you can calculate billions of them per second, so you can effectively go through and brute force. So the answer to your question in terms of what is good is one of these adaptive hashing algorithms where you can increase workload. So things like built in the .NET framework, we've got password-based key derivation function, PBKDF2, where you can say, look, let's just hash it many, 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 many times over, 10,000 times over. Other ones that are very popular are things like bcrypt, where you can say, look, I'm going to define a workload. So instead of being able to calculate, let's say, 2 billion hashes a second, which is what you can do with the likes of SHA, I'm going to be able to calculate maybe only a couple of thousand per second.
I see, so it becomes less opportunistic.
Yeah, correct. And like a couple of thousand a second is still fast, right? But what you're doing is you're increasing the effort required in order to crack to the point where it's going to become unviable for anything other than a really, really bad password.
Absolutely. And so once you do all this, like I'm trying to think of like, you're doing a salted hash with random numbers.
Random bytes,
and you do it 1,000 times. When you're getting their password and having to hash it, do you have to run that 1,000 times?
Yeah, you're doing the same thing. So here's the trick, right? Because you want to make it slow enough that if an attacker gets your data, it's going to be hard to crack things. But not so slow that when you get 20 people logging in at once, the CPU is just sitting there going, I'm trying, you know, and you're basically denial of servicing yourself. So you got to find that sweet spot.
So back to this, so it looks like you were on 3. People can go here and put their email in there and find it. Where is this data coming from?
Comes from a lot of different places. So let's take something like Ashley Madison. So when Ashley Madison hit, it was torrented extensively. Yeah. So there are links in Twitter to torrents. I have people privately send me things as well. I'll come back to that because that's interesting.
Sure.
But a lot of it is just distributed through public channels, and the big stuff tends to get torrented. Our hacking team got torrented as well, an Italian security group that made pretty nasty malware for governments.
Yes.
All that stuff gets torrented. To the point about information coming privately, I get a lot of emails from people that know I run this service, that sort of want to support it, and they'll contact me and say, look, this has just hit the airwaves, here you go. And the trick for me now is the people that come to me and go, I just hacked this out of such and such, would you like it? I'm going, oh man. All right, first of all, go to your room, think about what you've done, because often it is kids.
Yeah.
But I end up now having a lot of discussions with people about responsible disclosure, saying, look, you don't want to make this, like, just have a think of the ramifications of what you've done. You really want to go and find someone at that organization, let them know about their vulnerability, and let them fix it without spreading this information all over the web. And the curious thing I'm finding, and this is one of the new talks I'm doing at the moment, is that so much of the time it is kids breaking into these systems. Things like AAA Web Host was probably a kid, like either legally 16, 17 or something, or younger than us, and sure. therefore they are a kid, right?
Sure. Yeah.
But just very young adults that really haven't thought through the ramifications of what they're doing. And the sad thing is, the sort of data breaches we're seeing in here, the perpetrators are often ending up on the news, turning up at court with their mum and then getting custodial sentences or criminal records or things like that,
yeah.
because they have literally done a copy and paste into an automated tool.
Oh my goodness. Well, so you have these, you have this data that you get. Obviously, this is a massive amount of data.
Yeah.
How are you dealing with this? And then when Ashley Madison stuff hit, I'm suspecting your hits went way up.
Yeah, well, this is the good Azure story. So this is the right show to talk about Azure, right? So one of the reasons I created this service to begin with is I really wanted to build something on Azure in anger, right? So yeah. I wanted to do something that wasn't Hello World, yeah. that was actually useful, and it actually used some scale. So when I kicked off, I think I had 170 odd million accounts, and I thought this would be a good case to play with table storage.
Right.
So table storage, super, super fast, super cheap, just scales out almost infinitely for all intents and purposes. And that was great. And then what I didn't realize at the time, but the other thing that this would really demonstrate with Azure is the ability to scale in a very elastic, very rapid fashion.
Sure.
So give you an example, Ashley Madison. In the space of 24 hours, this site had to scale to support 58,000% more traffic. Like this was crazy. This went into seven figures of page views per day from four figures of page views per day, like literally overnight. It just went absolutely nuts. So that the challenge for me, and I've had other incidents like that, not that big, but other cases where I've woken up and gone, wow, that's look what happened.
Yeah.
It's always in the middle of the night too, because I'm in Australia and it happens sure. during the day in the US. So I did a lot of work with things like how do I set my auto scale rules, what do I want to scale to, how do I make sure that the underlying data structures will actually support things just going that nuts. And what I was really happy about with Ashley Madison in particular, I mean as happy as you can be about
yeah,
anything
sure.
like that, is that it had that crazy sort of 58,000% odd growth. But I ended up getting to the end of it, and I was worried about two things. I was worried about how much traffic have I lost because of the demand, and then how much is it going to cost me? And am I going to have to explain to my wife that there was this adult website and now I owe some money? what ended up panning out is my stats showed I had like 100.00% uptime, so I lost nothing.
That's good.
And the cost over and above my normal traffic to support these millions of people over the space of several days was $130, which is like a nice dinner out.
Yeah.
But this is like millions of people a day. And that just blew my mind that it all worked so well.
Weren't you skiing when this happened too?
Yeah, I was snowboarding. So what I'd do is I'd snowboard down. I was with my son as well, so I didn't want to sort of ignore him.
Yeah.
And then I'd get out my phone and I'd be like remoting in and trying to, and that's really hard with gloves too.
Sure.
But I'm on the chairlift, you know. Okay, it's all going, all right, I put the phone away and we ski back down the mountain. But that sort of blew me away as well, because I mean, everything's always on the other side of the world for me, but I was up in the mountains in the middle of nowhere, sort of orchestrating these crazy things in the cloud and supporting millions of people. And like that is just cool.
And with 100% uptime.
100% uptime. The stats are on my blog too. I wrote a blog post about here's how Have I Been Pwned performed with Ashley Madison. And I'm very transparent. I just put all the stats on there, all the good stuff, any of the bad stuff, it's all on there. But that just turned out to be really positive.
So I know this about you because I follow you on Twitter. You do not make a stink about someone getting hacked unless they respond a specific way.
Sometimes I have pointed that out. So what tends to happen is if an organization does respond badly, and often that they'll either respond badly to an incident or they'll respond badly to ethical disclosure or right. someone calling out the fact that they've got a security issue. You know, if they take it on board and they want to try and fix it and do the right thing, then myself and many others for that matter will do everything to help them. But every now and then, organizations just respond badly, or they respond in an obnoxious way, or with information that's just incorrect. And sometimes I help them understand a little bit more.
An example of that, I think, was the recent Steam problem. Mm. You remember that they were caching things wrong? That's what came out later. And all of a sudden, I'm logging in, and I'm like you, for example, and I have all your credit card and all that other stuff. And if this happens, right?
Yeah.
The best thing to do is say, look, this happened. We don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
We're going to try to fix it, but we're shutting everything down right now to protect you. That's a lot better than saying, everything's okay.
Yeah, and that was sort of the case. I've written a lot about these, but things like AAA Web Host, while I was still here on the screen, I couldn't even get those guys to listen to me. You know, I was submitting tickets, and I had to and fro with like support people going, let them know right now that you've got 13 million people that are out there. Yeah, okay, we'll think about it. We'll get around
and that. And that kind of response, I would just be like, oh my goodness, someone needs to get fired, and it's probably going to be me.
I know. But, you know, in fairness as well, some organizations actually respond really well and really productively. And the reality of it is data breaches will happen. And we've got Patreon on here. Now, I wasn't personally involved with Patreon, but when I look at the way these guys responded and the messages that they sent, you know, doing things like just simply saying, we're really sorry about this. Many organizations will just go hell-bent on blaming the people that hacked into them, who deserve blame. Like, let's not beat around the bush here. But they had low-hanging vulnerabilities that allowed this to happen. You know, we're in the UK at the moment. The big news here a couple of months ago was the telco, TalkTalk. Uh-huh. TalkTalk got hacked. And there was a lot of talk at the time that, you know, it's going to be cyber terrorists or very, very scary things like this. Mm-hmm. And a lot of blame was directed that way. It turned out to be a 15-year-old kid. A 15-year-old kid and a 16-year-old kid, and this really old guy who was like 20 years old, and that was who broke into the system. And the organization really just needed to own the problem and say, look, you know, we ultimately screwed up. We had a bad vulnerability, and we got compromised by kids. Yeah, and I just think that there's a lack of taking accountability for their own mistakes in these things.
Got it. So moving on now, we've talked a lot about these organizations, but effectively, we are also that organization. What are some things we can do to protect ourselves? What are the low-hanging fruit that we can just sort of remove so that, because look, everybody knows that crime is a thing of opportunity.
Mm. Yeah.
And if there's an opportunity, like if you leave something out and if someone's a thief, they're gonna steal it because it's easy to steal and they can get away with it. What are some low-hanging fruit that we can just sort of cut right off immediately?
Well, there's a couple of different ways of looking at this. So one is, what is the thing that keeps going wrong that get all these companies compromised, and how can we avoid that? And the answer to that is, it's often SQL injection. So good old classic SQL injection, which has been around since forever and a day. We know very, very well that was the vector with TalkTalk the other day. And that is a tool where literally the children can copy the URL and paste it into dedicated software. Our software, like SQL Map, designed for testing for SQL vulnerabilities, and then here is all your data. Like they just click run and then they go and play or something like that, mm-hmm. and they come back and all the stuff's out. So you know, these known vulnerabilities are a big problem. But I guess what that leads to, and my vested interest doing a lot of training, is that it's an education thing for developers.
Sure.
So we have developers, I mean, people like you and me, we've all built systems before, who are building these things without knowing what SQL injection is, without knowing how it works, without knowing how to defend against it. So that the number one thing to do, and this is really the best bang for your buck as well, is to train the developers to recognize these security patterns.
And here's the thing, like SQL injection, I had a customer many years ago that were like, hey, look, we need to rebuild this system, but the company that we're currently on, they are like, they're holding our data hostage, and I'm just like, oh, this stinks. Well, I'll rebuild it for you, and let me go see if I can screen scrape your data, because at least you can do that. So I go in there, and I'm like, oh, let me try something. Semicolon. Boom. I saw right away that it broke it. Yeah. I got an ODBC error back in the day, and it gave me the path to the Access database.
Yeah.
And because of the way they had set it up, I could go to that path and just download
it. Just download the whole database. Oh man, those are the days.
And I'm just like, oh my goodness.
That the funny thing is, and I actually did this in my workshop yesterday, I shouldn't say funny, but you can go and search for, you can use a Google Doc, so one of these carefully crafted Google searches, to find websites running classic ASP that have a query string, and probably, I would say, half the time, if that query string was expecting an integer, and let's say, for the sake of example, it didn't get an integer, you would see a database error, and those sites are vulnerable. There's just a huge number of sites out there that remain vulnerable.
And here's the thing. You're thinking, well, I got a database error, no big deal. But the problem is most of the developers are printing out the version of the database. the type of database. And all I have to do is go and just be like, oh, let me see, what version is this? Oh, there's a vulnerability. Okay, let me download this code. There was a gentleman, he was an IT guy. And he comes to me, he's like, ah, I'm running Linux, I'm totally secure. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, you couldn't get in there. I'm like, are you sure? He's like, yeah. I was like, I'll tell you the IP address. I'm like, okay. He told it to me, I queried it over all the ports, did a port scan, found out the version of a particular file server he was using, found a particular exploit to it, downloaded the C code, and he's watching me do this like in 10 minutes. And he's okay, you can stop.
Yeah,
and this is ethical because he said I couldn't do it and he gave me permission.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of this kind of stuff, right?
It's very easy. The one that's been very popular just in recent months is searching for exposed MongoDBs. So you can go, we won't actually find the database, but a site that's very, very popular for finding things on the internet is Shodan. So if you go to shodan.io, it searches for things on the internet. And what I like about this is a little screen here that says you can search for webcams, buildings, and one of them says fridges. You can search refrigerators. There you go. You can go to Shodan and search. Now, I don't know what you do once you find the refrigerator.
Right.
But it indexes all of these things on the web, and you can search for them. So the Mongo story was, you could go to Shodan and you could search for MongoDBs that did not have any authentication on them. And you could just connect and download things. And there are a lot of them out there.
Yeah, that's not safe.
No, it's not good. And look, it's a shame because it's just that one tiny little thing that has to go wrong, right? And there's this saying I like, which sort of says, as developers, we have to get it right every single time, but the hacker only has to get it right once.
Yeah, well, I guess the best way is to limit your exposure. So you talk about SQL injection, there's probably other things. Is there like a top 10 list somewhere?
Yeah, there is actually OWASP top 10. So Open Web Application Security Project. While we're here, we can bring that up. And the OWASP top 10 is a really good resource for finding, or rather identifying what these vulnerabilities are. So this is an open source, or rather open not-for-profit organization. And they create this great list which talks about things like SQL injection, cross-site scripting, all this sort of stuff. And they explain very, very clearly what it is, how to defend against it, what the impact is if you don't. And they've got heaps of really good material and it's all free.
That's awesome. So where can people go to find out more about sort of your work? I know you have tons of Pluralsight courses on this. Can you tell us maybe, if you had to choose two or three, which ones would you choose for Pluralsight to learn about this kind of stuff?
Well, I think since you're on OWASP, probably my OWASP top 10 for ASP.NET developers is a good one. So that's a Pluralsight course, which goes through their definition of the top 10. It shows you how SQL injection works and cross-site scripting works, and then shows you how to protect it in .NET. That's a really good one. There's a bunch of others I've done lately, things like browser security headers. I've got a course on browser security headers, content security policies, HTTP key pinning, which are two things that 90% plus of web developers don't know about, but are actually pretty awesome. And just a heap of other stuff. I'm doing an ethical hacking series at the moment, and I'm just finishing editing the social engineering piece, which is quite different and kind of cool.
Yeah, and that's something that we don't take into account. Let's just say, as a developer, you did everything perfectly.
Yeah.
That social engineering one will get you every time.
I know. Like, you're going to store all the passwords just perfectly, and it's going to be great, and then someone's going to call up the user, and they're going to say, hey, we're the help desk. We just need your password, please. And they'll go, yeah, here you go. No problems.
It's like everything you've done.
Yeah, hacking humans is actually really fascinating.
That's awesome. All right, well, thanks so much for spending some time with us, Troy. Again, please look at his Pluralsight course. This is something we have to do. I literally spent, and just as an aside, I spent the first two workshop days in Brock's and Dominic's, how to do authentication and authorization properly, and it was a doozy.
Yeah, yeah. And there's 2 days just to learn how to authenticate and authorize because
it's
a big
thing. And
it should
have been 4 days.
There you go.
Because the whole token thing and then the CSERF problems that happen if you're writing just a spa type applicant, it's just ridiculous, man. We need to keep up with this stuff. Use Troy as a resource, obviously, his Pluralsight courses. Thanks so much for watching. We're here at NDC London 2016. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Channel 9. We'll see you next time. Take care.